Today, as Boris Johnson decides the fate of HS2, we ask if Europe's biggest infrastructure project will be good for the North. And making the decision to have an assisted death. If you live up north, you might know these sounds pretty well. Old creaking trains, chugging slowly along. Overcrowding, delays, cancellations. The sound of many years of underinvestment. But could a solution be on the horizon? In coming days, we're expecting the government to finally make its mind up about whether or not HS2 will go ahead. If it does, by 2040, we should have a high-speed rail link from London to Manchester and Leeds via Birmingham, at a cost of up to £100 billion. Boris Johnson got his majority by winning seats in traditional Labour heartlands, including across the north. And some are selling the project as a way of levelling up the country, rebalancing the quality of infrastructure across England. But some Northern MPs, and according to one recent poll, a majority of Northerners, are not convinced. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, is HS2 really for the North? Helen Pidd, you're our North of England editor. Why did you go to Winsford?
So I decided that I wanted to speak to ordinary commuters who were suffering their regular rail journey in the North of England. I was looking for a railway station on one of the two main lines in the UK, either the West Coast Main Line or the East Coast Main Line. And Winsford is on the West Coast Main Line. So Winsford is a town slap bang in the middle of Cheshire in the northwest of England. It's fairly big. It's got 33,000 people living there. And it's famous locally for one thing and one thing only, and that's its huge salt mine, which runs right underneath the town. Like 50% of the grit that's sprinkled on roads in the winter comes from Winsford. So that's its big claim to fame. It's about 30 miles away from both Liverpool and Manchester. So in some ways, it should be an ideal commuter town. But it's not.
So how did the people you spoke to on the platform rate their rail services?
Well, they were just sort of resigned to pretty terrible services. It wasn't that busy for 7 a.m. You'd have thought there would have been lots of people getting on a train to go to Manchester or Liverpool, but it was like maybe 12 people, something like that. And no wonder, really, because even in the peak rush hour, there are only two direct trains that will get you to Liverpool in time to start work at 9 a.m.
And what's the service like to Liverpool?
Oh, it's always like going out.
So I heard a litany of complaints from delays.
But my busiest email address is the claim line for the trains.
Oh, that's depressing, isn't it?
It is, but it's part and parcel of life, so I don't let it affect me anymore.
Yeah. To infuriating cancellations if drivers don't turn up or are ill.
Yeah. The bit that's annoying is when you've waited for a train and then they say, because somebody hasn't turned in, there's no train. I've got no, you know, contingency plans if somebody doesn't turn up.
Like 15% of all trains from Winsford were cancelled last month.
Pretty much every week, yeah. And then obviously getting home when the train's cancelled from the other side, it's a nightmare getting back when you've obviously done a full day at work and then you've got to wait an hour and a half for another train.
And, of course, overcrowding.
Well, regular services would be ideal going to Liverpool. I've been using this train for the last 20 years, and when I started using it 20 years ago, there'd be six or seven people on the train. Now the train is packed every morning. The 7:42 is, the 8:05 is, the 9:05 is, so there's a lot more.
Is this the train now?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, it sounds a bit like the type of scene I imagine is being replayed on platforms all over the north.
Yeah, it's my life.
Tell me.
Every morning in the Stockport suburbs, me waiting for my two-carriage train, despite it being like the 8:15 train that everybody wants to get to Manchester in time. You know, you might be in a major city in the north of England and the story's the same. You'll have a short-formed carriage, which was probably built in the 1980s and might have been based on a design for a bus rather than a train. You know, screeching brakes, leaking toilets. You know, you can forget about luxuries like a plug socket or Wi-Fi. Just want one with a roof that doesn't leak. And everybody just piles in. It's just completely lacking in dignity and let alone comfort.
I was going to ask, how cosy does it get on your two-carriage train into Manchester?
It gets very cosy, all too cosy. But they really smell of wet dogs, these old Pacer trains. It's kind of disgusting. It's just a real source of frustration. I put my headphones on, try and close my eyes and just will it to be over.
I mean, I can not only feel it from your voice, but I also, of course, read your reports and follow you on Twitter. This is quite frustrating, isn't it?
It's incredibly frustrating and it really affects your life. Time and time again, when I've been doing reports on the poor rail service in the north of England, people are saying, you know, as soon as I can afford it, I'm getting a car. And, you know, we should be moving away from that kind of thinking and doing anything we can to get people out of their cars and onto public transport.
And obviously, transport frustrations exist all over. I mean, I live in the southeast, but I have moments of sheer frustration on a train platform. But there are problems that are very specific to the north, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it is a universal source of frustration, public transport in the UK. But there's this vast disparity in terms of the money that's been spent on transport in the north of England. So there was a study by IPPR North, a think tank, and they worked out that if the north of England had received the same transport investment as London over the past 10 years, then they'd have had £66 billion more spent in the north. So there is that big disparity.
Few could say that they didn't see it coming.
Train operator Northern.
The crisis hit train operator Northern.
Chaos on Northern Rail.
After 18 months of troubled headlines, cancelled services and crammed commutes, today Northern has been stripped of its franchise.
The service has been so poor on Northern Rail, which operates many of the lines in the north of England, that in January, finally, after months, if not years, of complaints by passengers and local leaders, the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, decided to take the franchise back into state control. And from the 1st of March, Northern Rail services will be run by civil servants rather than a private company.
So, look, Boris Johnson says he wants to level up the country. Just this last week, he suggested that one way to do that is with the biggest revival of infrastructure since the Victorians.
We will spread hope and opportunity to every part of the UK.
In other words, he's framing HS2 as being part of the solution to the problem you're setting out. Just start by telling me, what is HS2?
So HS2 is usually described as a high-speed rail line from London to the north of England. It's not quite true. It sort of undersells it. It's actually a high-speed rail network. So basically, it takes you from London to Birmingham, then the line splits and it goes in two directions. It goes up towards Manchester in the west and to Leeds in the east.
The High-Speed 2 network will transform rail travel in Great Britain. It's the backbone to a new high-speed Britain, connecting the north and the south, linking 18 cities and cutting many existing journey times by almost half. With up to 36 high-speed trains running on the network every hour, it'll put two-thirds of the population of northern England within 2 hours of central London.
It could take an hour off the journey from Manchester to London. So instead of taking 2 hours, 7 minutes, it would take 1 hour, 7 minutes. Leeds to London, instead of being 2 hours, 11 minutes, it would be 1 hour, 21 minutes. Birmingham to Leeds, it's crazy at the moment. It takes nearly 2 hours and that would be cut down to 49 minutes. And HS2 has been in the pipeline for a long time. And the timescales keep on slipping, but the current estimate is that the first phase of HS2, which is London to Birmingham, might be open somewhere between 2028 and 2031. And we probably won't see HS2 trains reaching Manchester and Leeds before 2035 or maybe even 2040. So 20 years down the line.
2040. I mean, I'm not that old, but I'll be reaching retirement by then. Yeah. not far off. And you know what? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's one of the reasons that I myself often think of it as a high-speed link between London and Birmingham, because it's so long before we'll see it stretching beyond that. I mean, what did the people you were speaking to in Winsford make of it?
A lot of people kept saying things like, well, I'm not bothered about getting to London any quicker.
Shaving 20 minutes off my journey to London, it's neither here nor there, but it takes me 4 or 5 hours to get to York.
Right.
Because you have to go to Liverpool.
And for most people, they were saying, well, I never go to London anyway, so it doesn't matter to me. And people were worried about the destruction of the countryside, the amount of money that has been spent already.
There's more problems to solve on the railway than building something else and destroying wildlife and people's homes. Mm. Just to build a railway.
Lots of suggestions that the money would be better spent on the NHS or education. I mean, there were commuters that I met who did like the idea of faster journey times. But there is another argument that doesn't really get an airing, and that's got nothing to do with speed, but it's about capacity. And there was one man on the platform who I was mithering while he was trying to buy tickets.
I'm distracting him with this ticket machine.
My ticket.
How many tickets have you got there?
My ticket into London is £277.
Which were £277.
£277.
Oh my God, rip off.
He was suspiciously well informed, and it turned out at the end of the conversation he fessed up and he was an engineer for Network Rail.
No, I don't think that the journey time's that important to me. I think the journey time's very good at the moment. I think it's a reasonably quick service down West Coast. Obviously, I'd like more trains to stop at Winsford. But journey time it's not what it's about. I look at the growth in the rail industry over certainly the last 10 years, but probably the last 15 years, whilst I've been using the service regularly. And, you know, I can see there's massive demand. And
for me, it's capacity. You know, if you look at these services travelling into Liverpool or Manchester.
OK, so if it's not all about speed, what is the capacity argument?
The capacity argument is quite simple, and it is that if you take off the existing main lines, all of the fast trains that go from Birmingham and London to Manchester or going further up to Scotland, take them all off the existing railways, put them on this new line or lines, HS2, and you free up an enormous amount of capacity. At the moment, these fast intercity trains are kind of like the bullies of the railway. They go really fast and they're really long and they take a long time to stop, which means that they cause all kinds of problems in the timetable because you have to leave a really big buffer between them and the little local services that stop at places like Winsford. And it means that there's very little room in the timetable for these local stopping commuter services, which is actually what most people care about much more than getting to London a bit more quickly.
So what you're saying is, once you move all the fast trains over onto a new HS2 line, assuming the government would be willing to buy more slower trains, then you could almost have like a conveyor belt of them all travelling along at the same speed without much gap between them, which I can see would indirectly solve a lot of the problems you heard about in Winsford that you experience every day, infrequent trains that are hugely overcrowded. Why don't you hear this argument being talked about more?
I don't know. I think that whoever's been doing the PR for HS2 has done a very poor job. The problem is in the name, High Speed 2, all about emphasising getting somewhere a bit quicker, whereas actually I think your average person cares much more about having a better choice of trains on their local networks. But yeah, sure, somewhere like Winsford could go from having one train an hour, which is all they have outside the peak period, to maybe having four. And that's quite transformational. It means you can probably just turn up to the station and just, without even checking a timetable, something that commuters in the southeast and in London are just used to. You probably don't even ever look at a timetable. You just turn up because you know that there'll be a train there in a few minutes.
If that becomes a reality, it could be great for somewhere like Winsford, but the north is vast. I mean, what about the northeast, for example? Even if HS2 trains end up going there, the fancy new lines won't. So presumably these arguments carry less weight up there.
So in terms of the capacity argument, there's probably about 100 stations, HS2 reckon, that are on the existing east and west main lines who will benefit from that. HS2 would argue that, say, if you lived in Newcastle, you'd be getting your train down from Newcastle and then you could pick up the high-speed line at Birmingham or maybe at Leeds. But yeah, sure. I mean, the Northeast is always the loser when it comes to particularly transport investment. You know, sometimes I think that we're hard done by in the Northwest, but the Northeast, you know, just to do a really simple journey can take several hours. It's really very poor up there.
Okay, so one counter argument, maybe that HS2 is only going to benefit some parts of the North. But even in a place like Winsford, which will be directly affected, there are potential issues, aren't there? I mean, this has been hugely controversial already along the route from London to the Midlands because of the impact on local residents, but also the natural environment, including biodiversity. Are these arguments being played out up north?
Because the northern sections are still very much on the drawing board stage, it hasn't got quite as acute as it has been down in the south of England. But of course, there's ancient woodland that would be destroyed to make way for HS2. Habitats of rare butterflies and owls and bats could all be at risk. HS2 would say that they're creating new wildlife havens and that they've part of the reason they've already spent £9 billion on HS2. A lot of that has gone on environmental mitigation. So they have done an enormous amount of work to work out, you know, where will the bats sleep if you know, their usual perch has been bulldozed.
Where will the bats sleep?
I don't know, on the other side of the railway track. But of course, you know, these are very important issues that really matter to people. On the other hand, building a brand new railway line should be good from an environmental point of view because you're getting people out of their cars, which means that air pollution should go down. And it should go some way to reaching the UK's goal of becoming carbon neutral. On the other hand, people would say that there's so much concrete that's going to be used in this construction project that it would take decades before the project would have kind of paid for itself in carbon terms.
So that sounds really complicated. And then there's the other issue, which is people's homes that are along the route and will get seriously affected.
Yeah, it's often dismissed as NIMBYism, but I would be upset if I received a letter saying, you know, sorry, Helen, we're going to bulldoze your house to make way for this railway line, or if it was kind of at the bottom of my street and it would keep me awake at night. You know, that one of the most famous examples in HS2 terms is a brand new housing estate in Mexborough, which is near Doncaster in South Yorkshire. And a couple of years ago, like, the builders were just putting the finishing touches to this housing estate, the Shimmer estate, and then people were just moving in, and then they got a letter saying, oh, sorry, HS2 is going to come through this estate. We're going to bulldoze the lot.
Pete and Sue Douglas retired here 3 years ago, but are being forced to move.
Frustrated, angry, upset.
It's the way we've been treated by HS2 and the government. Yeah. It just compounds the idea that we don't count as people anymore. We're just bricks and mortar. We don't have lives. We don't have rights.
You know, I think it's very real, very painful for people. And there's been lots of arguments over whether HS2 is paying a fair rate when they've been compulsorily purchasing these homes. And it's also the question of blight. You know, your house might not be directly in the path of the train, but maybe your house is next door to it. And will you be able to sell your house in the future?
Okay, so those arguments are ones that have already played out, as you say, across the south and will affect the north. More specifically, thinking about transport in the north, are there arguments against spending so much money on HS2?
Yeah, there's plenty of arguments against HS2. People say spend the money on the form of transport that most people actually use in the north of England. You could spend it on buses. Far more people travel to work by bus in the north of England than train. If you want to be a bit more eco-friendly, people talk about, you know, setting up massive electric car charging networks. But probably the most popular one is to build something called Northern Powerhouse Rail.
Northern Powerhouse Rail is a programme to deliver a transformational rail network for the north of England.
So sometimes it's confusing. It's got lots of names. For a while it was called HS3 and then it was called Crossrail for the North. But George Osborne, I think, got his way in the end and it was called Northern Powerhouse Rail. So what this is it's a new east-west railway line that would go from Liverpool in the west, right across to Hull. And it includes large new sections of track, and it also piggybacks on bits of the HS2 line. And it should drastically reduce the journey times between northern cities. I mean, one crazy statistic is that at the moment, it's quicker to get the train from London to Paris than it is to get the train from Liverpool to Hull.
We're currently making the case for investment and working with the government. We're looking at how best to deliver this transformational network for the north.
I mean, you've been talking about linking London to the north, but from the sounds of the people you've been speaking to, including on the platform in Winsford, what people really want to do is link east to west. So if you really want to help the north, shouldn't Northern Powerhouse Rail actually be the priority? Shouldn't they at least do that first?
And that's exactly what quite a lot of people have been saying, including some of the new Tory MPs who broke through in the so-called red wall seats.
Hello, this is Andy Carter, and I'm the Member of Parliament for Warrington South, and we're standing on the bridge which crosses the Bridgewater Canal. Now, I'm calling on ministers to review the plans for HS2 and to put more focus and more emphasis onto improving rail connectivity here in the northwest of England by investing in the second phase of Northern Powerhouse Rail 2, which links Liverpool to Manchester.
That but when you start to look into it, if you talk to, as I did the other week, I had a meeting with the guy who is in charge of Northern Powerhouse Rail, and they have been working on it for several years now, the plans. He just says, listen, we have designed Northern Powerhouse Rail to work in tandem with HS2. Northern Powerhouse Rail uses 80 kilometres of track, HS2 track, including a really expensive tunnel from Manchester Airport to Manchester Piccadilly. And it's they're designed to work together, like hand in glove. You know, I was talking to Steve Rotherham, the mayor of Liverpool City Region.
Right, I've got okay. some doubt about whether we'll ever see the thing, but there you go. If we get them both together, then I'm politically supportive.
Liverpool doesn't even get a proper HS2 stop, but he's kind of in favour of HS2 because he says that without it, Northern Powerhouse Rail doesn't work.
It's called classic compatibility. This is not my terminology, by the way.
Classic?
Classic compatibility, yeah. So in other words, our trains then...
Yeah, but I said to him, all right, push comes to shove, which one would you rather have, Northern Powerhouse Rail or HS2?
No, mine's absolutely... I think it's a genuinely unfair question that the northern leaders get asked, and the south don't.
And he said, why do people keep on asking us to make this decision? They always do this to northern leaders. London never has to make this decision. London leaders are never told to choose between a third runway or Crossrail or improvements to the docks or the Thames Barrage or whatever it might be. And he says, therefore, it's not fair to make the north choose one or the other, especially with this backdrop of such vast underinvestment in northern transport infrastructure compared to that in London and the South East.
But if, and as I said, I've got some reservations, but if it goes ahead, then I think for us, the Liverpool City region, and I have to be a little bit parochial sometimes, given that I represent 1.6 million people who have been left behind, then for us it could be an economic boom.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings us to the crux of the problem, doesn't it? I mean, the mayor of Liverpool is in favour of HS2, but is more broadly frustrated by how the economy has so long focused on London, which brings us to the politics. You know, you mentioned some of Boris Johnson's MPs being not that supportive of HS2, and yet others are arguing that he wants to push ahead with it because he thinks it's a way that he can keep those borrowed votes from across the north.
Yeah, I mean, he wants to have something to show for his promises in 5 years' time when he goes to the polls again. And we know that he really likes big infrastructure projects. Some of them have been more successful than others.
Now, here we are in the middle of London. This is the top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall. This is the rooftop garden that they've built up here. Completely wild, I'm surrounded by vegetables and plants and bees and the sound of birds twittering. And beyond that, the city, the concrete, the hard business of a city at work. It's fantastic. It's this juxtaposition of something really strange. Gardens in strange places. That's paradise for me.
He wanted to build this garden bridge across the Thames, him and Joanna Lumley.
For the past 17 years, I've been working on and dreaming of a bridge which will cross London in complete silence. a bridge with a garden on it, a pedestrian bridge with a garden on it.
And it was going to have like flowers and trees and look very beautiful. But they managed to spend £53 million before anything was ever built.
Now, I hope, my dream is becoming a reality. The planning work has already begun.
A £200 million plan to build a bridge covered with trees over the River Thames in London has officially been abandoned. More than £40 million worth of taxpayers' money has already been spent on the project.
What about Boris Island or that bridge that's going to link England to France and I think Scotland to Ireland?
Yeah, he's a bit like a boy with a Lego set, isn't he? Just like the idea of building stuff. And I think he, you know, when he's been deciding in the past couple of weeks whether he should give the green light to HS2, he's probably thinking, well, if I don't say yes to this, you know, what photo opportunities will there be for me to stand in a high-vis jacket and a hard hat and show that we're building for Britain and, you know, renewing our Victorian architecture? And he'll be absolutely milking that over the next 5 years. And you can see why he would, because he'll be able to point to a concrete investment, which he would say is working to bring the country together after a period where we've been very much divided.
But this idea that the Prime Minister might be doing this for the politics of it, the optics of looking like he's doing something for the North, might worry some people, given that ultimately it's still 20 years away from actually getting to Leeds. Rhetoric around politicians trying to transform the North isn't new. I mean, you mentioned George Osborne's Northern Powerhouse. Is there a fear that even if both phases of HS2 are approved, it might never get all the way up to the North?
It's a very real risk. So, you know, Peter Mandelson had a letter in the Times over the past week. He, of course, used to be the Labour MP for Hartlepool, so he does know the north of England fairly well. And he said, you know, this is a trap, because what's going to happen is they're going to spend so much money on London to Birmingham that the public appetite won't be there to spend any more money. And then the easiest bits to cancel will be those northern legs. I would say that politically, that would be very, very difficult for Boris Johnson to stand up in Parliament and say, actually, we're just going to stop this super-duper fast railway. We're just going to stop it at Birmingham, because then really the benefits are for London. They're not even for Birmingham that much. It just makes it possible probably to commute every day from Birmingham to London. And the meanwhile, you know, probably the north of England will still be rattling around on Pacer trains.
Helen, at the end of the day, it's clear from what you're telling me that there are concerns about HS2 and there's so much more to figure out around infrastructure in the north. But there are clear benefits. And the truth is, we're not starting from scratch. This is what's on the table right now, ready to be approved or binned. What will the impact be for the north if HS2 doesn't go ahead?
I've spoken to really senior people who privately say, yeah, we should have started at the north and gone down rather than starting in London. You know, maybe they would have thought of a different route. But you know, the real danger is London's already very good at agitating for better, bigger things. You know, Crossrail 1 is already vastly delayed and over budget and it's not opened yet. But there's lots of people who would like to see Crossrail 2 be built. And it's much easier to make the economic case for infrastructure in London because it's such a densely populated and already wealthy area. Therefore, the returns that it generates are much higher than if you, I don't know, build a new railway station in Bradford, which is what would happen with Northern Powerhouse Rail. So there are lots of dangers for the North if the project were to get scrapped.
Helen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Helen Pidd, The Guardian's North of England editor. Do follow her reporting on HS2 and her personal transport woes, both online and on Twitter. Her handle is @HelenPidd. Coming up, what goes through your head when your loved one wants an assisted death?
Bookmarked an article but never returned to read it? You're not alone. With The Guardian's Audio Long Reads podcast, you can listen to expert writing on a diverse range of issues whenever suits you. From immigration...
At each appeal, she was refused the right to stay in the country.
...to cult novelists.
He could not avoid writing murder on his list of options.
For long-form journalism without all the reading, listen to The Guardian's audio long reads wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, in 2017, Jemima Dixon, or Jay, who suffered from a complex form of multiple sclerosis, died in an assisted death at the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland, becoming one of hundreds of Britons who have chosen to end their life this way. A new episode of the Guardian audio series, The Story, explores the complex emotions felt by Jemima about her decision and by those closest to her. We heard from her sister, Annabel Dixon, about how she has grappled with Jemima's enormous decision.
Jemima was a really kind and loving woman, and I think probably because our parents got divorced when we were quite little, she always felt the need to look after me, whether it was she felt like I was being bullied at school or whether it was about a boyfriend, whatever it was, she was always somebody to be looking after me. Through her teenage years, she was quite rebellious and a bit naughty. You'd quite often see her donning a catsuit and heading off into London to go and do a bit of raving. Through her 20s, she started developing her career in London and quite quickly progressed. But when she got ME, the doctors basically said to her that she needed to go and take time out, stop working, leave London, go home. And that was really the beginning of the sort of 17 years of illness where she had sort of degenerative diseases which progressed over that time to the point where she ended up bedbound and wheelchair-bound with full-time live-in care. She was in a lot of pain. Every day she'd be in pain, and through the time that her illnesses degenerated, ended up taking, 50-plus pills a day. And she was really terrified of dying without control. She was fearful of stuff happening and her ending up in a really horrible death where she felt that the palliative care services might not have supported her to relieve all the pain that she would have been in. And so she was very fearful of that kind of death. Dignitas for Jay was an opportunity for her to control her end of life in a way that she wanted to at a time that she wanted to do it. Once she fixed a date with Dignitas, it was the most extraordinary thing because my mum and I at that point were deeply grieving with Jay still there, which is an odd thing to happen. But also, Jay was just so happy. I hadn't seen her that content for many, many years. In fact, she was joyous. It was just the weirdest thing. She was a bit scared of telling people because she didn't want anything to get in the way of her being able to go to Dignitas. But she did at a point nearer to her end date. And Jemima, through that time, was mostly really, really happy. Lots of people came to see her, so she had the opportunity to say goodbye to people, and they had the opportunity to say that they loved her and share stories and experiences that they'd had. We did have a couple of evenings where we were up really late into the night. We were really lucky. The weather was amazing up in Wales. And so Jay, who would normally be tucked up in bed, you know, by 9 or 10 o'clock, was up outside in her wheelchair, sloshing back the booze. And if I'm honest, she did start smoking again in her latter moments. So she was fagging it and boozing and really loving it. We just did a lot of laughing at that point. There were some fun times mixed in with the grieving. Jay died on the 5th of July, and she was quite clear actually on how she would feel if assisted dying was legal in the UK. She was really fearful of not being able to get to Switzerland and make the journey. And so she ended up going way earlier than she would have naturally done if she was able to do it in the UK, either at home or in a secure environment, which, I mean, for me, I find really hard and is partly, obviously, why I have been doing some campaigning to change the law in the UK. I find it hard to kind of look at the fact that actually I feel like our laws and our government have stolen years off her life. And I, you know, what do you do with that? You can't really do anything. People are wary of assisted dying, and I do understand it. Often it's the people that campaign for disability charities that are quite concerned about changes to the assisted dying law. And I think that's because they see vulnerable people who could be taken advantage of in those sorts of scenarios and maybe forced into having an early death by people wanting to get inheritance from that person. But I do believe it's possible to put the right processes and procedures in place to prohibit there being any problems with that. There are many countries across the world where there are assisted dying laws in place, and they've proven through review of those processes that they are successfully running without any issues for people with disabilities or any vulnerable people. One person goes to Dignitas every week from the UK. And on those stats, it feels to me like we're outsourcing death to Europe. And those are the lucky people that can afford, you know, it costs Jay maybe 12 grand, somewhere around that sort of amount of money. And not everybody can afford that. So it's sort of putting a massive wedge in between people that can afford and people that can't afford the end of life that they want. And that just can't be right. It just can't be. I'm really hopeful that the law will change. But, you know, unfortunately, that doesn't bring Jemima back for me, and although it's what she wanted, it'll never be something that was right for me.
That was Annabel Dixon. Thanks so much to her for talking to us, and do listen to the amazing episode of the story, Jemima, Who Owns Our Life, on the website. If you're affected by any of the issues raised in the UK and Ireland, Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123 or via email at joe@samaritans.org. Other international suicide helplines can be found at befrienders.org. That's it for today. My thanks to Helen Pidd and Annabel Dixon. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier and Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.